Manning on 2FM.
2FM.
Tonight at 9 o'clock, parts 1 and 2 of Murder at the Cottage, The Search for Justice for Sophie, will air on Sky Crime. The director is Jim Sheridan, and he weaves together the twists and turns of the crime that shocked Ireland back in 1996. The story of the murder of Sophie Toscan de Plantier is one that Jim has wanted to tell for an awful long time, and he joins me now to tell us what to expect. Jim, you're very welcome to the programme. Come on, sorry to interrupt your lunch. I believe you're eating, are you?
No, you know what it is? I get smoked almonds and you don't want to hear them crunching on your show, Dave. You know?
Right, OK. That's a first. OK, Jim, I'll tell you what. Just let's take a look at this first of all, because there is news that has come just about this documentary or like that's on tonight, two parts of this. I mean, first of all, let's just take that. Like that. All episodes of Murder at the Cottage, The Search for Justice for Sophie is available on Sky Crime and Now TV as well. Parts 1 and 2 air on Sky Crime on Sunday at 9 p.m. There's five parts altogether. Some things have had to be taken out because the family of Sophie Toscan de Plantier don't want them in there because they thought you were going to be making something different than you did, and they got them taken out by Sky. If I buy the box set, if I look at something else in some other way, can I see what you actually made?
No, I don't think so. You know, we didn't want to put the family, Sky didn't want to put the family in a bind, you know. So I think eventually what I made will come out. It's not that much different, to honest to God, Dave, the two. It's just damaging and you know, that you know, you don't want to be the person putting them in a bad position, you know. And so I didn't want to do that. I mean, I respect them and love them and feel for their grief, you know. And, you know, I was just cognizant of that all the time.
Well,
so, I think without doubt, somewhere down the line, a director's cut will come out, probably, and I would hope with the approval of the family.
Right. Now, I mean, the thing is that you say that, you know, as a filmmaker, an awful lot of stories obviously fascinate you, and this one's been sticking with you for a long time, not just since it's happened, but in particular over the last 10 years, and in the last few years, you've been working on it. I mean, so you say this story compels you. Why does it compel you more than others?
Yeah, there's two answers to that. One is that, you know, I wrote a movie in America about, like, basically the death of my brother Frankie, and I've written another story about that. And so this, you know, when you're 17 and you're going to confession, confessing to, you know, bad thoughts and impure actions, you're kind of in a vulnerable place. And suddenly my brother got a brain tumor, and I was praying to God, and then he died, and then I was like, okay, I'm done with God, you know. And so that on the one hand is over there, and the other is that my mom, I went on the 8th of May this year to a grave up in Louth to a woman called Mary, who died in childbirth, and she died giving birth to my mother. And my mom, I think, blamed herself and could never quite shake the, you know, feeling that she'd been responsible for our mother's death. And in a way, my mother was the first unjustly accused. And I think I have a total passion for that. So on the one hand, my young brother relates to Sophie and no God in the world. And the other, my mother always loved outsiders. And there was one particular person in our family who nobody else in the family ever made eye contact with, and was visited first by my mother, and it blew the woman's mind because my mother was so kind. And, you know, and I think that kind of drive is in me, you know, the drive for, you know, I'm not saying that 100% Dean Bailey didn't do it, but, like, there's no evidence, you know, so you're kind of going, like, come on, guys, you know?
There is a lot of circumstantial evidence.
Big what?
Well, OK, first of all, the bramble kind of, you know, scratches right up his arm all the way from bottom to top, and he claimed he was cutting down a Christmas tree. The blood on his forehead, he claimed he was hit by a turkey.
OK, well...
Hold on, that's just two. Hold on, there's a few more, too. Three times he said he did it. And the DPP has decided, you know, well, look, obviously he was just being sarcastic because he said himself he was being sarcastic. I mean, there's quite a lot of sort of circumstantial.
Well, let's start with your first one.
Right.
The scratches on his arms.
Yeah.
If the scratches were on his arms, he wasn't wearing a big, heavy black overcoat, okay?
Okay.
He took the overcoat off the killer and then put it back on. Is that what you're saying?
No, but I mean, in a struggle like that at the bottom of the hill down from our house, anything.
Yeah, well, I rolled around in those brambles, Dave, just to check it. As opposed to climbing up a tree to see if you don't get scratches, I rolled in the brambles to see if you do get scratches. And I dragged them and pulled them and did the best I could. And I filmed it. And for 2 days after, nobody noticed I'd scratches.
Okay, hold on a second then. They also claimed that he never got up once he went to bed at night, and then they admitted later
on
himself and Jules.
Just go back on the second point you made, the thing on his head, yeah?
Yeah.
There's about 500 statements about that and the scratches. But the Christmas swim video, you don't see any cut in his head and you don't really see any scratches on his hand. The actual visual evidence contradicts all the statements.
Yeah, but that Christmas swim was done on a kind of a quick Super 8. And there's not an awful lot in there. You know, he recites a bit of a poem.
I know, but the statement taken after was that he took his hands out of his pocket and shook hands, whereas in the video, his hands are already out of his pocket and he's waving the camera. So you can discount the statements.
Well, you can discount an awful lot of statements. In fact, I might as well stay with one now, and that's Marie. I mean, just tell me about her situation and the whole idea. What do you think of her evidence, of her lying about her name, Fiona, twice, of eventually coming clean because she makes a phone call from her house and then the police...
Well, let's take all of those. Marie Farrell is trying to help the police. She's guilty because she's seen something that's upset her, which is a 5'8" man with sallow complexion and a beret outside her house. She then sees the same man at Kilfada Bridge, and that turns into a 6'4", pale, long-haired Ian Bailey. That's why the Director of Public Prosecutions wouldn't allow him to be charged. That very simple fact was written up by, I would say, a brave enough man in the Director of Public Prosecutions office who had nothing to gain by writing his report. So Marie Farrell calls us Fiona, it's her sister's name, because she doesn't want to get involved, embroiled in it. And then the police make a call to her, and I think, I'm not sure now, but I think it was on a confidential line. Am I right there?
I'm not sure, yeah.
Well, there you go. You're not sure, but can you trace a call on a confidential line?
No, but my point is, like, you seem to be believing whatever parts of the Marie story that you want to believe. I mean, like, maybe she's lying from the word go, because she's certainly...
Totally. But if she's lying for the word go, Ian Bailey's not at the scene of the crime. So you can't have it both ways. You can't have that she's only telling the truth when it's related to Ian Bailey.
No, but I mean, she does have it both ways in terms of the fact that she's driving home at 4 a.m. or whatever, and she's with somebody else and will never tell us who that somebody else is. That's a bit I don't understand. And she's looking at this guy walking along the road who's kind of, you know, maybe slightly drunk or whatever it happens to be, etc. And she makes up this story possibly, or else it's true. But the one thing about it is, if she's a witness in a very bad murder, the simple point is that the second witness, the guy in the car, who she never tells us who it is.
Okay, well, I'd simply, if I was a policeman,
yeah,
and I heard her saying that very early on, I would say, unless you tell me who it is, I'm arresting you for protecting a murderer. Like, there's simple solutions to when somebody won't tell you a fact. Why did the police never do that?
But when she was questioned in court, what did she do? She got up and left. She ran across the road.
Totally right. In fact, I commend her for that, and I know you think that's crazy.
No, but do you commend her for then 100% changing her story?
No, I don't. I think look, they spent 9 days trying to prove that a self-confessed perjurer was in fact a liar. Like, we know she's perjured herself. There's no value to her evidence after that. You know, so you either make an emotional, spiritual evaluation. It's a spiritual as opposed to logical situation. Do I believe her now, or did I believe her when she said it was Bailey? Which do you believe? Which do you believe, Dave?
I don't know, because I mean, like, I've listened to all of West Cork only in the last few weeks. By the way, I know it's quite old at this stage. I also watched all five programs of the Netflix series starting next weekend as well. I don't know. I mean,
well, Netflix is not ours is five part or Netflix is three.
I mean, three parts. Sorry, I watched all that too. So I mean, like, you know, 3 years ago, GSOC, you know, the Garda Síochána Ombudsman Commission, an independent kind of statutory body, they did establish how badly the Tosca and de Plantier case was handled. Like, they have admitted to the limits, if you like, of the original investigation. So do you think then we'll have another one? Do you think they should go again? Don't forget, he's never been charged here, Ian Bailey.
They should 100% start with the man outside the shop 5 foot a sallow complexion. They should start with facts.
Well, wait a second. That's not necessarily a fact.
Well, why is it not a fact?
Because the person who's telling you about the man outside the shop is one who has lied through her teeth.
I know, but you can't have it both ways. If she's lying that it was Ian Bailey, it's not Ian Bailey. If the first statement she made was that the man was 5'8", sallow complexion with a beret, and there was no pressure on her, she wasn't talking about being out late at night, that's more likely to be true than after the police interrogate her and have the thing over her that she was out late at night. You know, like... Yeah. She's compromised at that point. And she's a very brave woman, I believe, to come out later and say, look, I was lying. Because she's not going to win anything. All she's going to get for the rest of her life is hassle. So why would she do that? Now, I said to her in the dock, did you do it because you were being paid? And she wouldn't even take a euro from me to be in the dock.
No, and neither did Ian Bailey. And Ian Bailey says he's not looking for sympathy. He just wants honest, truthful objectivity. So, like, that's what you give him. There's no question about that. But, I mean, like, this is a man who has, you know, he seems to enjoy the spotlight more than he probably should. And don't worry, I'm not saying that makes him guilty. I'm just saying, like, he had a libel action against the newspapers in 03, a civil action against the Irish state in 15, a criminal trial in France, which we know about. And, like, obviously... he was
okay, but I have a question, Dave. Who would you rather? Would you rather have the Guildford Four, who all signed confessions?
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Or Ian Bailey? Which do you want now?
Okay. Okay. Is there not enough even circumstantial evidence for the DPP to have done a little bit more than it might have done, and could they now do it and with even more evidence down through the years?
The DPP, James Hamilton, I interviewed, and he was like, if I put Ian Bailey on trial, it would have collapsed in the first day.
Okay, yeah, all right.
And, like, these are, you know, do you remember when you were a kid, Dave, and you went, well, we did in Sheriff Street, we went, L.O.B., L.O.B., it's the law, and a police car would come. Rarely, but sometimes. That police car is not the law.
Yeah, I mean, no matter what the police do here, it has to go to the DPP.
Yeah, and the other way around in France, the DPP type of operation precedes the arrest in France. So that's why the French are confused. The family, they think that we've gone through the process that the investigating magistrate in France goes through. Ours is reversed. And there's some good things in the French system, like they protect the name and identity of the suspect, which we don't hear.
Do you think in some ways, like, I mean, this is really quite glib, but throwaway, is that, like, you know, here you're innocent until proven guilty, and it's the other way around, maybe, possibly, in certain other countries, including probably France?
No, I don't think it's not really that clear-cut.
Yeah.
But, like, I'm not, like, you know, the issue here is not really did Ian Bailey do it, did Ian Bailey not do it. The issue is, have we investigated this fully? And the answer is unequivocally, no.
Right.
They weren't allowed to interview anybody in France. There's not one statement from anybody in France except the family that they got in the hotel who came over to identify the body. Now, that's wrong. That's simply wrong. If European law is not federal, like it is in America, they should have allowed the Irish police to investigate Bruno and Toscan de Plantier and other people. It's just wrong.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's definitely true. But I mean, also, like, you know, if Sophie's family had decided to let you keep all the stuff that you did with them in the programmes that you have, there was only one way you would have probably been able to do that, because, you know, if they wanted to end the grief, to do that, you would have had to point the finger at Bailey, because that's all they want, really, isn't it? I mean, to deal with the grief, you had to become, you know, it's...
I would say that's probably true.
Yeah.
I mean, look, at the point at which we started, you know, the Jinx was a famous murder, you know, where Robert Durst confessed on a tape in the bathroom.
Yeah.
Now, it turned out, after all the hullabaloo and after all the, oh my God, we caught the killer and all the huge PR it got, the case collapsed. The case collapsed because I think, now, I'd have to check my facts, so I'm only putting out what I believe and not what I'm sure of. But I think they had edited what he said on the tape, yeah?
Well, yeah, but hold on a second. Again, the amount of evidence against Robert Durst, and this court case is still coming up, by the way. I mean, it's absolute, to the point where his brother has two bodyguards, because the guy, like, there's dead bodies which were, he cut pieces up and threw them in the river, etc. And he killed his partner, Berman, or whatever her name was. I mean, like, there's so much evidence against the guy. But he has millions. He has O.J. Simpson money to make sure something doesn't happen, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's the problem with the law. You know, if you've got a lot of money, you might, you know, escape. But Durst, I think at some point the family may have believed that we would get a confession from Ian Bailey. And I tried my best. Like, I started out just like every person. Like, I wonder would he ever trip up. And I gave him a camera to film himself, and he must have filmed himself, like, for hours and hours and hours. And he never confessed. I would have given it to the family if he confessed.
The three confessions that he did make to three people who say he definitely made these confessions, do you think that's, that he was just kind of being very Ian Bailey about things, that he was just kind of trying to be sarcastic?
Well, I think a case will come up about the fourth confession he made.
Is that to the two people who came back on New Year's Eve for a drink and fled the house
no,
very
quickly?
No, that's
about the, you know, Nick Foster said he confessed to a
crime.
Oh,
yeah, the book. Yeah.
That's the fourth. I call that the fourth confession.
Yeah.
And we'll deal with that later.
Right, OK, so there's more to this. So, but this story still stays with you then. So, I mean, like, you know, you didn't have an agenda as such. You just wanted to, as you say, this story didn't just fascinate you, it compelled you. So do you now have a much fuller understanding, do you think?
I think I do. I still have an agenda, and that's to investigate it properly.
So, in other words, do you want the Gardaí to reopen the case then?
Well, the problem is if they can't ask questions in France, I don't want them to open the case. If they can ask questions in France, I do.
When you went to France, there's bits in the documentary of going to Sophie's grave, and you mentioned earlier on about going just in terms of County Meath. What does that do to you, Jim? Just the silence of you standing there looking at the grave.
Yeah, it's very, very. That's what drove me to my grandmother's grave. You know.
Yeah.
It's like, it's profound. But like, I was in France yesterday.
Right.
I was doing my own investigation, you know?
In other words, it continues. Whatever we see with these programmes...
Yeah, it continues. It will continue. I feel a duty to just follow to the end of the line any information I get, you know?
Do you think the French trial was a grotesque miscarriage of justice?
It's a complicated thing that the French trial was only basically what the magistrates would have done before a real trial. But it was a pre-trial so that they could extradite Bailey and actually try him. They weren't going to put him in prison for 25 years. They were going to bring him back and try him at a new trial, you know. So it wasn't a conclusive trial in that sense, you know. It was only as if the magistrate was appearing in public and saying, we think he should be arrested, and now we can't arrest him, yeah?
Okay, and like when you went to West Cork, were you surprised, were you apprehensive about the access that you might get, and were you surprised at just how much you got?
I was surprised. I think, you know, it's, for some reason, I have a good, mostly, I don't know why, empathy with people, and I usually can get the truth out of them, you know, usually. I think the difficulty every human being is getting the truth out of themselves. That's where the poetry is. Mm. Getting the truth out of others is a technique or an emotional thing, or you're blessed with empathy and people sense it, you know?
I mean, like, you seem to get on very well with the Duplantier family, and unfortunately people aren't going to necessarily be able to see that now because of what's happened in the last few days. But the Duplantier family, they believe that he got away with murder. Do you think that the evidence most definitely does not support that in terms of Ian Bailey?
I would say the evidence doesn't support that. But it's not 100%, obviously not 100% conclusive. Mm-hmm. But I don't think a trial of him would stand up in Ireland. I put it in the documentary that I don't think Marie Farrell was allowed to go to France, you know?
Yeah, I mean, like, the law under which he was, taken in France, it doesn't exist in Irish law. It's this Napoleonic law that permits the examination of a crime against somebody, you know, a French citizen abroad or whatever it happens to be, or somewhere.
Yeah,
yeah, it dates back to all that. Ian Bailey was arrested a few times, I think 97 and 98, etc. He was never charged, and you think that's right because there just isn't enough. I mean, By the way, when I mentioned the GSOC earlier on, like, you know, they did find no evidence that Gardaí falsified evidence to incriminate Ian Bailey.
That's true. Like, that's an amazing fact. And I would say, there were two people in the course of this investigation who really impressed me. One was James Hamilton, the director of the Public Prosecutions, whose proof that our system does work and that sometimes it holds up. And the other was James Donovan, O'Donovan, who was our chief forensic man, who was the man who discovered the Mountbatten killer and who has been blown up twice and who has suffered for the country and who gets no recognition. And I don't think under his authority or jurisdiction that there was ever a falsified forensic in Ireland, which is an amazing fact that people don't realise how profound that is, given the Guildford Four and the Birmingham Six and the, I would say McGrahy in the Lockerbie trial and many cases in America. But this is there are really honourable, decent people in the DPP, up in the Phoenix Park, in the Guards, and I'm not saying anything about any of them. I'm just saying it wasn't conducted correctly. Quite correct. Maybe over-enthusiastic. Maybe over-emotional, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, it's on tonight and it's fascinating stuff. Well, the start of it is anyway. All episodes of Murder at the Cottage, The Search for Justice for Sophie. It's available on Sky Crime and Now TV as well. Parts 1 and 2 air Sky Crime tonight, Sunday. And you can get the rest. You can check it all out where. Just look up Google and you'll find it all at some stage. So finally, just one last thing, Jim, to get off this entirely, is you're looking at another story. And that's the story of the Lockerbie disaster. The search for justice there of one father whose daughter was...
Sorry, Dave, to cut across. Yeah. That's almost the opposite of this, in which Jim Swire, having gone down of his own accord into Gaddafi's compound and asked Gaddafi to send McGrahy to trial. And Gaddafi hugged him and said, we're two fathers who lost a daughter. And McGrahy was sent to trial. And at the trial, Jim began to feel McGrahy didn't do it and went to visit him in jail. And he gets the same level of attack from the American families,
Mm-hmm.
It's just like they're 100% convinced that McGrahy did it, I find Jim's humanity and Christian values.
It's astonishing. I remember seeing him on the news at least three or four times a year, every year from 1988 onwards. He was constantly on. He was really brilliant and absolutely determined to come to a conclusion that was the right one. Yeah, I do remember that. So that's a Lockerbie doc or a Lockerbie series maybe that you're going to bring out sometime soon?
Yeah, it is. And you know, in that, there's a piece of detonator called PT-35B or something. And that's the question about evidence. And, like, the guards didn't put Ian Bailey's fingerprints at the scene of the crime. The guards didn't put his blood at the scene of the crime. The guards didn't put the blood on his coat. So it's the guards haven't been malevolent, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, listen, Jim, thanks a million. Sorry for taking you at lunchtime here on Sunday. It's half one now. Jim Sheridan, thanks very much indeed for talking to us. And it's on tonight at 9 o'clock. Thanks a million, Jim. Come on.
Okay,
take
bye
it easy. All right, bye. Good luck.
Dave Fanning on 2FM. 2FM.